Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm David Ewing Duncan, journalist and chief correspondent on Public Radio's Biotech Nation and author of Experimental Man. So tonight, we're talking about innovation and crisis. But let's not kid ourselves. Humanity is facing a series of crises as challenging as any that we've faced. Top on this anxiety agenda, if you will, is the economic crisis and the crisis brought on by global warming and the degradation of the environment. Can we overcome these crises? Or more to the point, are we clever enough to overcome these crises? Here in California, we're particularly enamored with the notion that technology can save us, that we can innovate our way out of just about anything. Personally, this makes me feel anxious, possibly because I've lived here for only about 10 years, which actually is a long time when you think about it. And I do make frequent trips to New York City and other places that maybe are a little more skeptical about all this. But tonight, we have a distinguished panel that's going to help us find out and talk about if we can innovate our way out of this crisis and possibly more. We as humans seem to keep getting ourselves into these messes. And on my left here is Paul Sappho. He's the esteemed forecaster and essayist. He's a board member of the Long Now Foundation and currently teaches at Stanford. His essays have appeared in Fortune magazine, Newsweek, The New York Times, and more. He's also currently a columnist for abcnews.com, writing on technology and innovation issues. And I looked at some of these columns before coming over, and I suggest you all do the same. They're wonderful. Jonathan Wolfson is CEO at Sulazyme, Inc., a renewable oil production company and the leader in algal synthetic biology. Yes, this is algae, the little pond scum creatures. Wilson has held a variety of positions in finance, business, and law, everywhere from Investor Tree to Morgan Stanley and Seventh Online. And next, oops, we're a little mixed up here. Anyway, next is Richard Dare, the president and CEO of Pacific Rim Partners, a private firm investing in and advising cross-border businesses in mobile technology, energy, aerospace, and defense and consumer retail products, a wide range of things. Dare is widely considered a leading expert on the impact of global technology and commercial transfer on culture. And then last but not least, down at the end there, we have Drew Indy, a synthetic biologist, and he's teaching as an assistant professor in bioengineering at Stanford University. With other professors at MIT, where he was teaching until recently, he's working on synthetic biology and the engineering of standardized biological components. And we'll find out more about what that means, and we are going to find out what that means, hopefully, in a minute. Please welcome our guests. All right, my first question tonight, and by the way, we will talk among ourselves here on the panel for a little while, and then we'll welcome your questions a little ways into this evening. My first question for the panelists is basically the premise of tonight's panel. Is it true that we as humans can innovate our way out of crises, especially the crises that I outlined a moment ago? Anybody want to jump into that? Paul, you're closest.
Well, there's good reason to be a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist. History informs us that's generally how things turn out. Of course, the problem is that every other crisis we've been through, we knew how those turned out, and they turned out okay. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So what makes this moment different in time is the fact that we don't know what's going on. I will say one thing about this particular region, Silicon Valley, is quite special. Silicon Valley is a place that is built not on the spires of earlier success, but the rubble of earlier failure. We fail our way forwards. Sometimes I think we have an architectural advantage. Our buildings in Silicon Valley are two stories high and surrounded by grass. So when people jump, they just sprain their ankles, you know, go home and notice there's a business plan on their laptop. And there's an intrinsic optimism in this place. And I think that, though that is specific to Silicon Valley, that may be the secret sauce to saving ourselves this time around, is a fundamental optimism that we can get ourselves out of this mess.
Richard?
Yeah, I agree. I think we can. I think it's a safe bet to say that, because if we don't, it won't matter. None of us will be here. So,
unless you're one of the survivors.
You can quote me that it's all going to work out. I don't want to underestimate how awful some of the situations are. I'll particularly focus on the economic situation. And so I don't want to create a rosy picture as though there's nothing wrong. There is something wrong. But it reminds me a lot of, I don't know if you remember back when you were in college, and you know, you really didn't have anything other than ideas. And you know, you had all these dreams of things that you wanted to build and you wanted to do, and you were going to go out and conquer the world. And eventually you might have woken up some 10 years later and you had all kinds of stuff. You had a house and a car and a mortgage and a dog, and you want to go on vacation, and you know somebody's going to watch the cat. And life becomes, you're not really necessarily progressing the way you want to. And you may have, as I have with my wife, had the conversation where you'd say something like, wouldn't it be weird if you came home and everything burned down? You know, what if it was all gone? Well, that's what happened. And so the good news is somebody, you just got home, and somebody burglarized your home. They stole most of your money. They stole your 401k. They destroyed your pension plan. They're completely ripping you off, and they're going to continue ripping you off, and there's not much that you can do about it. And then they lit a match to your house and burned it down. But what strikes me, David, is that in almost all of our country's short history, the time that we almost always are the best is when we have these tremendous crises, you know, whether it's World War II or, you know, you kind of go back throughout all of the big turning points. That's what Americans are really good at. We're really good guessers. And we're really good in a pinch. And we really kind of suck when it comes to just systematically doing things, you know, working, you know, sort of in a very measured way. We're not so great at that. And, in fact, we end up kind of engineering ourselves into these kind of weird places where sort of culturally, you know, we'll build we'll take an escalator up up every stairway in our building so that we can save our energy so that evening we can go and work on the Stairmaster. You know, and we kind of have these really sort of strange things where we're moving, but we're not really progressing. And to me, what's exciting about this time, and again, I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about it. There are a lot of people who are hurting. There's a lot of awful things that are going to happen to people. But what's really great, in my opinion, is that this is the first time in my life that all of the pieces are being thrown up in the air, that all of the large institutions are really at significant risk for failure. And that's just, to me, the most exciting thing I've ever seen in my life. Not that the institutions were bad, but boy, you know, there are so many great ideas. There are so many things that Americans have historically been good at, which really is kind of, I think we've got an enormous sense of intuition as a nation. And I say that as a person who spends half my time in Japan, where there's a very measured kind of process orientation and maybe a little bit less of the intuition. And we have this great history of commercializing things, and I think this is our time.
Richard, I'm going to jump in here, and we'll get to Japan, I promise. Jonathan, just is innovation going to save us?
Well, I'll try to be as innovative as I can, but Paul and Richard, you know, there's a little bit of thunder stealing here because these guys really nailed it, actually, on a lot of levels. I think, you know, it may seem, you know, one of the points I think that's really interesting is the fact that this is the first time, at least in my relatively short lifetime, but I think historically in the history of this country, that there's a collective recognition of the size of the problems. You know, if you think about it logically, you realize that we've ignored and exacerbated problems around the environment, around healthcare, around wealth distribution, around education. And I'll borrow another college analogy. You know, my best work came at 4 a.m. before a 9 a.m. exam. So, it really did. And I think that, and that's the way that companies operate. They operate best when faced with real challenges. And just look at the history of innovation. You can take Silicon Valley. You know, some of the most successful companies here were born in the roughest times, clearly. And this is a place where failure isn't failure. It's learning to succeed. I can actually say that one firsthand. I started a company in New York in software in the financial services industry, and really great timing. I started it in December 99, which is about as good a time as you could pick for a financial services software company. And it didn't go exactly the way that we hoped it would. And I came out here and was trying to raise money, and this is 2003 when we said algae. And we said algae and advanced fuels, and people said, what? And the life sciences guys said, wow, that sounds cool. Go talk to the energy VCs. There were five of them at the time. And the energy VCs said, wow, that sounds really cool, but we don't know anything about life sciences. Go talk to the life sciences VCs. But the fact of the matter is, this is the best platform for innovation, because people are really willing to fall down, pick themselves up, learn from their mistakes, and move forward. And in a crisis is absolutely the best time for the big problems to come out. And I believe the opportunities now are absolutely enormous. And not to undersell the hardship that many people are going through, but I think that some really important solutions are on the way.
I do wonder here where they hide the bodies, though. Even though it's only two floors you jump out of, there have been a few, I think.
They're not as sweet as they look.
Anyway, Drew, at the end there, we've had some optimists here. I think you are too. But
will innovation
view?
Save us? No. Sorry, these opposable thumbs by themselves probably aren't sufficient. It's an interesting time for me, looking at our civilization through a very short window of time, but seeing the footprint we have on the planet, and wondering whether or not we're now able to take responsibility for many of our actions. And so how do you couple innovation with responsibility in order to save us? And is that something worth saving, or do we just keep jumping out of windows?
I think that's an interesting question about responsibility. But before we get into some of those deeper philosophical issues, let me ask each of you. I did ask you beforehand. I just gave you one question in advance, which was to spend, in our age of Twitter here, I'm going to give you more than 140 words, but 2 or 3 minutes, if you have a big idea for, you don't have to pick the entire crisis out there, but maybe a part of it that you think might change things and innovate us into something that might be more positive in a time of crisis. And anyone can jump in here.
I think Drew is the most optimistic, so start with him.
Yes, explain yourself, Drew.
I mean, you know, what's exciting to me is we're now at a point in our civilization where we can take responsibility for the living world ever more so. And the question becomes, can we transcend our approach and relationship to biology such that we're not simply existing via biology, but we're realizing our humanity and whatever that becomes by taking more responsibility for the living world? There's actually an interesting quote from the artist here in this gallery talking about how he is hoping to filter nature through the process of technology, which is why you see all these interesting shapes made out of car paint on the wall here. It seems to me like the opportunity we have is to figure out how to make the engineering of biology easy, but also to make the engineering world come alive. The things we make with our thumbs, our civilization and the artifacts that we live within are oftentimes inert and dead and sterile. The most alive thing in this room is the little textured pattern of the pine from the forms that were used on the reinforced concrete over there, an echo of that living artifact. What if we had a living building itself? What if we could engender a way by which the full creative talents of humanity would help us enact a civilization that's in balance with nature and bringing it forward in partnership with nature, as opposed to the decoupling that we've got now? So I'm optimistic. I'm really optimistic, but I'm not optimistic on the basis of my thumbs alone. I need to understand and take responsibility somehow for more of the world I inherit.
Okay, who would like to go next here? Jonathan?
Well, I like the pine too, but...
Yeah, by the way, for our radio audience, we are in a gallery here, and there are paintings on the wall, and the references being made are to the space here.
I think, you know, people's comfort zone is often to spend time talking about and arguing about what they know, and I could remove myself from my comfort zone, but I'll choose not to. And therefore, for me, I listed a bunch of problems: environmental, healthcare, wealth distribution, education. You can come up with a lot more. The one I spend my days thinking about is kind of a several-pronged, which is environmental degradation that's caused by our energy demands and issues around energy security as well, which affect all of our lives. And I have to be very pragmatic about it because people ask us every day, why does what you're doing matter? Why does it matter? Why should we support you? I can break it down and I can think about it in as pieces to a puzzle. People, you know, we make diesel fuel and we make aviation fuel. And people say to me, well, biofuels are bad. And I say, well, no, actually, in many instances, they can actually be quite wonderful, but not in all instances. And well, why biofuels versus electric vehicles? How do you feel about the fact that people support electric vehicles? And my response is, I feel wonderful, and I'd like to drive my car from my house to my office on green electrons every day. I don't want to fly from here to New York in an electric plane that doesn't exist, and so I'll focus on the things I can handle. And how do we make a difference to encourage those kinds of technologies? Well, for me, I can actually boil it down to something I hear people talking about every day now. People talk about cap and trade, and they talk about carbon, and we think about carbon a lot. And I listen to all kinds of arguments about why cap and trade is very important, and I think very simply, well, if I was the one writing the rules, no, I'd just tax carbon.
Can you explain cap and trade?
So the idea, and this is closer to what Drew was saying about having a harmonious planet, and we say, well, how do we have a harmonious planet? We limit the emissions to a certain level, and you can certainly argue what that level is or should be in any given period of time, but you limit emissions to a certain level, and then you hand out the right to emit carbon up to that level, and you can trade those rights, you can sell those rights, you can buy those rights. And I come at it from a slightly different place, which is we need strong incentives to do the right thing, very strong incentives. And time is short, and we should be taxing carbon. We should be taxing carbon. We shouldn't be handing out permits to pollute that can be traded across from one person to another. We should be taxing carbon, and then we should be taking what comes back, and we should be investing it. How could we invest it? Well, you know, one way that's close to my heart is, you know, why don't you put that into refundable R&D or development tax credits? You don't hand it out in grants. Let people prove that their technology matters and that they can support it and they can demonstrate it. And then after they do that, you can help subsidize maybe 25%, maybe 50%, and you know what you ask them in return? You ask them for a piece of their business. And if the government is the one that's providing assistance to me to pay me back after I pay for R&D, then the government gets to own a piece of my business, and maybe they put it into an energy trust fund.
Now, that's interesting because I think what Jonathan is talking about is not only the science, because when we talk about innovation, I like to always talk about it's not just the science of technology, it's also how you implement it. And he's getting into some policy issues there. But Richard.
Well, yeah, I think that the implementation is what the opportunity is right now. And because there are technologies that already exist that we're not implementing really to the fullest extent here because we're not thinking big. And I think that it's partly our thinking has become somewhat lazy so that we celebrate very small incremental improvements. You know, some will develop a web 2.0 website, and it's pretty neat. It may or may not be changing the world we live in. It doesn't always have to, but you know, we just all go crazy about it. You know, wow, this is the most unbelievable thing in the world. But there really are fundamental things that society needs. Society, at some level, has to be able to power itself. At some level, we have to make some sustainable way of getting food, some sustainable way of having water. We have to move things around back and forth. So maybe as an example, as a very pragmatic example, look at transportation. We historically have a lot of large car companies, and we were some of the early pioneers in transportation in the United States. But I think most of us recognize that our kind of older American car companies are not really that exciting anymore. There aren't a lot of kids who are begging their dads, please, dad, please bring me that Chevy Impala home. And yeah, you know, we're saddled with this really big issue, and we say, well, how are we going to revive our transportation system? And we're talking about, you know, well, what should we do? You know, should we be GM? And we really need to think bigger. I think we need to get beyond that and stop trying to figure out how do we polish the tiny thing that we have. If you take an example, the only examples that I can give you are the ones from here in Japan, because that's the only place I go. But if you look at some examples of technology that already exists, Toyota brought the Prius here. So now we start to have a hybrid technology. That moves us incrementally. It doesn't solve everything, but it gradually begins to move us along. The problem is the battery life isn't really that great. So Keio University said, you know, well, one of the issues with the battery, a couple of years ago, said one of the issues with battery life is that it takes too long to recharge the thing. People are worried about moving all the way to an electrical car, because if you go plug it in, you don't want to be driving between here and Los Angeles and you have to plug the car in and wait for 4 hours. So Keio University said, you know, what about if we didn't put one great big giant battery in there, but what if we put like 2,000 cell phone batteries in? Because they can all, you know, recharge in maybe 10 minutes. So you put 2,000 cell phone batteries in, car recharges in 10 minutes. So then Honda took that this year and they said, well, what if we applied that to a really big SUV? And we, you know, what kind of mileage could we get with that? They get 466 miles to a charge. So now all of a sudden the car, and this car, by the way, the KO car has 540 horsepower. It's like a Bentley. So it's not like, these aren't like really, you know, the little, we have the sort of smart cars that, you know, that I think are designed maybe so that people will know that you're doing something socially conscious. These cars just look like cars. They look like nice, really comfortable cars. But then ultimately you want to get away from the idea of driving, because what happens when people drive? When people drive, you know, we get in lots of accidents. And we waste an enormous amount of time. When you think about the productivity of people who have to commute between, you know, one place and another, an hour and a half, 2 hours a day, twice a day, it's horrible. So they start to say, what can we do in the United States? Could we make maglev trains? Well, we really can't, because we don't have enough people. You know, we're really probably going to be stuck with cars. We're a really big country. But we could start to make intelligent cars that drive themselves. Now, you know, you've all seen the sort of DARPA research, and they'll have a bunch of test centers that they'll try and have. Every year they have contests for this in the United States. There's a Japanese company named Topcon that's in Japan and here in the United States. A year ago, they drove the first car that wasn't in a contest. It drove from the Embarcadero all the way across the Oakland Bay Bridge to Treasure Island, and it drove with nobody in it. Now, how could it do that? Well, the problem in the United States is that if you ever drive over our roads, it's like Kabul. You know, there are, you know, potholes everywhere.
US 101, yes.
Yeah, it's very, very rough. You might wonder, why are the roads so bumpy? Well, the state of the art right now to fix a road is two guys drive along in a truck with orange shirts on. If they feel a bump, one of them says, hey, I think it was a pothole. You want to stop? Or shall we, you know, carry on? And that's kind of the state of the art. So what we had to do here was to say, we're going to have to map the roads. So Topcon developed a technology that works now, that you can drive a car 60 miles an hour down the road, and it maps things to the sub-millimeter level in every single place. Now, what that does ultimately for infrastructure, and this is the last point on it, is now we can immediately say, show me all the potholes that are a certain size, a certain depth, exactly how much material will I need, and it's done. And that's the kind of idea we need to think about, rather than thinking about, you know, maybe if we put a spoiler on that car, people would buy it.
I don't know. I'm thinking we're in trouble if we're having to have GPS systems that map potholes on major highways. But anyway, Paul.
You know, I love feedback. This is a moment where pessimism is the new black. You know, it's just very fashionable to be depressed, and the title of the panel tonight was kind of that whistling past the graveyard quality. You know, can we innovate ourselves out of the hole we've been digging for the last 50 years? But, you know, pessimism is a new black at a very deep level. Think about the word sustainability and the environment. I mean, to me, sustainability is a deeply depressing term. You know, it's hanging on by your fingernails, just hoping you don't drop another couple of floors. I mean, can't we do better? And so the thing I would point towards is the issue of mindset. We're in a moment where we're looking for new ideas, but we're also in danger of applying old habits to these novel problems. You know, sort of getting used to the new normal and slipping back into an old groove. And that really frightens me. The danger here is to avoid slipping into the old groove. And give you an example in the environmental arena. There's a real debate between two camps. Call one camp the Druids and the other camp the engineers. The Druids say, let's back off. Let's just preserve everything and try and get back to where we were. And the engineers say, no. We can engineer our way out of the problem. And we had this with a proposal to spread iron filings on the Central Pacific to sequester carbon. Turned out it was an enormously bad idea. And the problem is that Druids are by nature pessimists and engineers are by nature optimists. And I think they're both wrong. And our challenge here is to not fall into the groove of the quick fix or abandoning the problem, but to think long, to keep the conversation sustained on the long term and not slide back to the idea of a deus ex machina, an innovative quick fix that's going to correct the last 30 or 40 years, because all that will do is make the problem worse. My good friend Stuart Brand puts it very nicely with the observation that I think we should all keep in mind. Our job in this immediate crisis, regardless of the short-term distractions, is to try to learn how to become good ancestors. And if we do that, we'll probably solve the short-term and not just kick the problem down the road to our children or grandchildren.
I'm still hearing a fair amount of optimism, despite what you just said, Paul. I mean, the fact that we might be able to actually pull out of this either in the short or the long term. I want to go back to Drew for a minute here, because, Drew, you've written about things like bringing back the mammoths and spaceships that self-assemble and enabling humanity, enabling wisdom. I mean, these are fabulous ideas, but at the same time, you're talking about responsibility, and I'm wondering how you yourself and your work connect this up into creating a new future or a new way of looking at things. But how do you connect up being basically somebody that's talking about developing very interesting, fascinating new, inventions, paradigms with the idea of responsibility and dealing with the fact that we humans seem to keep creating these crises over and over again?
So I'm an engineer. I'm not a druid, despite the name. And the opportunity to an engineer today is to look at the technology of biology, the living world, and to imagine and dream about how we could become much better at engineering biology. And so this gives a lot of people, including myself, pause, simply because at the moment our civilization depends completely on the living world, and we're not very good at engineering biology. And so that means if we make even modest improvements, we're going to have to figure out how to bring that to the table in a way that continues to be overwhelmingly responsible. I love the idea of becoming a good ancestor. And if you look at the living world which we inherit, it very much by definition comes from our ancestors, ourselves, but also the environment to an extent, and everything else we have to deal with. So let's put this in context for a second very quickly. In 1952, our country spent a tremendous amount of money building computers. These computers were things to be used in designing hydrogen bombs. Within a generation, from, say, 1952 to 1977, people became so excited about computers and the ability to compute that they went off and built their own computers. That gave us the Apple and some other things. And now, a generation later, we inherit web-based computing, the cloud, and so on and so forth. We're now one generation into biotechnology, and we've seen biotechnology, Genentech and whatnot, here in Mission Bay and San Francisco and what have you, really make a difference to many people in the world. Insulin for treating diabetes, for example, is a genetically engineered product by and large. But we're really only one human generation into this business. So if you wanted to bring forward the next generation, the teenagers who are going to inherit both the natural living world and the human-engineered biotechnology that we develop and deploy, how do you imagine biasing that snowball or avalanche or whatever the metaphor is in a way that continues to be constructive? We don't know what we're doing. We're running by the seat of our pants. Whether this crisis, as it were, provides an opportunity or a problem or a challenge, it's probably all of those. We do really simple things. When we set up a competition for students to battle it out with genetic engineering projects, we don't call it Bug Wars. We call it iGEM, for the Genetically Engineered Machines Competition, and we call the event the Jamboree, after the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts. Is this going to keep us safe and give us a living world of the future that we can pass on to our children and what comes after them? I hope so. Is it sufficient? No. But, you know, help would be the end point, I guess, to my thread.
Well, one thing I'm curious about, I mean, a lot of people out there, we're still a bit abstract here. What would you tell people that are really struggling right now? I mean, how can we, you know, how can they innovate? What can they do differently? Paul, you talked about in a recent column, the creator economy, or I guess it was an essay that you wrote. You talked about we've gone through in the last century or so a producer economy, a consumer economy, and a creator economy. You know, let me ask you, how do people that are struggling with their jobs and trying to pay bills, how do they become part of this creator economy?
I wished you'd ask me something where I could give an optimistic answer too. This is a revolution. We're in the middle of an economic revolution. I mean, we precipitated an economic crisis through a mixture of short-term thinking, stupidity, and outright fraud. And on the subject of fraud, I have a feeling we have barely begun to scratch the depths of the fraud. Bernie Madoff, I suspect, when the history is written, will be recognized as the least of the fraudsters and almost too small to worry about. But behind that stupidity, there really is a fundamental change in the economy afoot. And, you know, it would be cruel to put everybody to sleep describing the change. But I think we have to start by the recognition that real revolutions, people get hurt. People lose their lives, people lose their wealth, they lose their income. And the secret to surviving that is to stay focused on basics and also to help each other. So there is no short answer, but the place where we begin is this is a truly scary moment in time. And not to underestimate just how serious the economic crisis is ahead.
Richard, we don't have a big representation outside of California here, but you do a lot of work in Asia. What's happening in the rest of the world? I mean, are we living in a little bubble here in California that, you know, that we talk about all this innovation and technology and two-story buildings? What's happening in the rest of the world?
Well, certainly, you know, there's a lot of impact. And there's a lot of contagion from our economic crisis to their economic crisis. But I think the way that we respond to it may or may not be a little bit different. Or at least there's something we can learn by looking outside of, you know, what you sort of describe as the bubble. And I would come to almost a more pragmatic response that doesn't differ from Paul's, but would be coming down lower to the ground. I think it's a great opportunity for people to go back to school. I think it's a great opportunity for people to begin to dig back into the basics. I think that we have tried to develop a lot of innovation without a lot of understanding, with a lot of deep understanding of science. Drew, you know, you're probably the smartest guy I've ever met. So, but this is a different panel than people who are out there who are really, really suffering. And I think that we are going to have to roll up our sleeves and really get back to... We have to understand the basics of science and our world around us if we're going to really make a change.
Well, Tell me this. We've got a few more minutes here. I want to get back to this idea of we humans seem to keep getting ourselves into these messes. I mean, are we too pessimistic? Or are we too optimistic? Or is there a balance that we can
too
achieve?
Opportunistic.
Yeah.
Really.
Opportunistic.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you look at the United States, we if we have businesses that are judged every 90 days, where your head's on the chopping block every 90 days, you're never going to make a good decision. It'll just never happen. I remember the first project our company, our firm did many years ago was with Mitsubishi Corporation, and they said, we want you to help us with our master planning. And boy, I just, you know, wiped my hands together and I said, this is great, because I've read Michael Porter and I know a lot about master planning. I'm a really strategic guy. And I went in thinking, you know, I'm going to show you guys a thing or two. And I thought, you know, how long could their plan be? You know, what does a company plan? You know, 3 years, 5 years would be almost absurd here. And they pulled out a 300-year business plan. And they were not joking about it. They were absolutely serious. There was an army of dedicated men and women who every day go in and work on that plan, testing, measuring. And it led to all kinds of incredible things. And that's where I think that if we start to look in the long vision, we're going to have to dig our roots deeper in the basics. But then we'll have the opportunity to build the really big ideas and not just keep polishing the old ideas.
But, Jonathan, how do we do that?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, you know, I'll start out with how you don't do that, and then I'll move to how I think you do. I was at a breakfast last week, and we were speaking with a company that wanted to collaborate with us, and the guy who ran the company said that, you know, in 2006, before he had produced a drop of fuel, he had a market cap, you know, north of $2 billion. You know, and I turned to him and I said, well, did you create lasting value? And he said, well, there was value then, and some of it was realized. And, you know, I said, you know, very simply that, you know, long-term wealth follows great value creation. And what do you want? And it was very clear that that mindset of a narrow point in time and the opportunities that a narrow point in time presents to generate wealth perverts our system. And I think that there are things that are happening now which, you know, there's an inertia that's really going to help us to correct that a bit. Now, you know, one easy way I can tell you, you know, the word that, you know, one profession that people often don't think about is a profession of investment bankers, right? And these are guys, they show up every time there's a company that starts to have some promise and they want to start to get to know the people in the company and they want to understand whether or not this company has long-term prospects to go public or get sold. And so, you know, watching investment bankers is an interesting barometer. And the way that that some of these interactions have happened for me, starting in, you know, with this particular company in 2003, you know, moving to now, is that the questions that, first of all, there's a lot fewer of them. So when they show up, there's only two or three instead of six. And so that's an interesting thing. But the second thing that's interesting is the ones who are still there are actually asking much, much deeper questions about where the technology is and how the technology relates to commercialization. And I think that if you look at regulation, there's, you know, we're going to have a lot more regulation moving forward, particularly in the financial markets and financial services. And I think I view this all as very positive. I think you're going to see a shakeout of people who don't want to really create and are looking to take advantage of what the system offers. And I think that the things that float to the surface are going to be technologies and policies that are very well thought out and that are tested by the sands of time. And I'm very optimistic that a lot of great things are going to happen moving forward. That doesn't mean we're going to float out of the, you know, out of the rapids right now, but we certainly have a lot of opportunity to fix some of the things, and some of that is institutional. And so I view all this chaos as a way to take advantage of, you know, institutional inertia in the right direction.
Policy, right?
Well, I wouldn't disagree, though. As I listen to you, Jonathan, I'm reminded of the immortal words of John Jacob Astor, who, while sitting in the bar of the SS Titanic, was heard to remark, "I know I asked for ice, but this is ridiculous." I think it comes down to the fact we need new myths. We need new myths. The old myths got us into trouble. And there are some things that are really fundamentally changing. Stuff you can count on. The United States will not exist in 50 years. It may not exist in a lot sooner than 50 years. You can also count on the fact that sometime in the next 20 to 30 years, probably sooner, a major new religion is going to emerge. Religions are formed all the time, but, I mean, a major new religion. Nietzsche put it nicely when he said, nearly 2,000 years and no new God. We're overdue. People are desperate for new myths, and what we need to do is construct the right myths. So, you know, I second what Richard said about people going back to school. I teach at a small institution on the peninsula. We always love more students. But I think what we really need are poets and writers and artists and people, people whose imagination and horizons see no bounds. The folks who see the things that the rest of us miss, I think that's where our salvation will come.
Possibly philosophers as well. We have about 4 or 5 more minutes here of panel discussion, and those of you who have questions, why don't you start formulating those and moving up to the mic that we have here, and we'll start the Q&A with the audience here in just a moment. Drew, what any thoughts along this line of where the reality may be here as opposed to the myths or creating new myths?
Imagination is important. I guess the point I'm trying to make is to not see a dichotomy between the creative world of one family, the artists, the imaginatists, the people who can see things that others don't, and the folks who are brass tack and building stuff in the physical world. That our real opportunity right now might be to take those two worlds, typically disparate, and find a way to make a marriage, which makes things continue to be beautiful and improbable going forward.
Is it possible that combining some of the things we're saying here, a myth of responsibility and vision at the same time? Richard, what do you think about that?
I'm not sure if I understood the question, but if you want to restate it, go ahead.
Well, no, just combining some of these thoughts that we're having here where, well, you know, one myth that we might embrace in this country for a change would be responsibility as well as a reality. I know.
No, I agree with the tenor of what Paul said, as well as what Drew said, that this is a time to really bring these ideas together. What I think I would want to add to it, and I don't know if it's really responsive to your question, I apologize, but is that it's really the time to think big now. It's maybe one of the only times you've ever experienced in your life that your thinking big might get you somewhere. And that's what I really think. You know, and I think we have to be cautious. I think myths are important. We have to be cautious. There were a large group of sort of neoconservative people who wanted to put together a myth. And they said America needs a new myth. They came up with one. It didn't turn out so well. And, you know, so we don't want to take these things separately, you know, in one piece. I think we really want to approach this thing with a long view of, you know, what's the society that we want to have. Now is an opportunity where everyone really gets a voice, whereas everyone didn't really have a voice a few years ago.
Okay, I think we have a couple more minutes here. Jonathan, turn this. You're dealing you have a company and you're creating a product that's a very practical measure here. We're off on mythology and abstraction here. How do you get people to basically switch to algae, to get rid of fossil fuels and switch to algae?
You don't.
This is an example.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I can speak quickly, hopefully under 2 minutes, but the way that I think people adopt technologies is one through coercion, and there is going to be some of that moving forward, and there probably needs to be from a policy perspective. And two, sometimes you mask the medicine and you make it taste like cherry. And you know what we do is we make technology that fits into the pre-existing infrastructure. So you don't know. When you get into a car that's driving on an algal diesel fuel, it meets all the current fuel specs. It was produced in a pre-existing industrial fermentation infrastructure. We used the downstream equipment that was developed for the agricultural oil processing industry. and we use Standard Oil refineries, which, by the way, doesn't garner me a lot of friends when I talk about the environmental benefits, which are huge. You know, over 80% reduction in greenhouse gas footprint. They're more concerned with who your big oil partners are. And my response is, they own trillions of dollars of infrastructure. And if I want anyone to ever use my fuels and benefit from the low carbon footprint and the renewable domestically produced materials we make, we're going to work with those guys. And so the answer from my perspective to your question is try to make it fit. You need to have responsible policies with an element of coercion. And I could talk for a long time about that. And then, two, you need both the big idea, but you need incremental change also. The way we do it is a big idea, but the way we make it realized is barely incremental change. You could use a pre-existing car, unmodified.
Right. Okay, well, I think that will end our panel session here. And as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum. And tonight we're hosting Innovation and Opportunity in Crisis, The Future Emerges. I'm David Ewing Duncan, journalist, chief correspondent on Public Radio's Biotech Nation, and author of Experimental Man. And I'm here with Paul Saffo, technology forecaster and futurist, Jonathan Wolfson, CEO of Solazyme, Richard Dare, CEO of Pacific Rim Partners, and Drew Indy, down there on the end, synthetic biologist, Stanford University. Now, I think we have some people who have some questions from the audience. You'll step up to the microphone there, and if you can keep these as brief as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Hi. My name is Natalie Zaytouni, and I was very inspired by Paul and Drew's vision and by Richard and Jonathan's hands-on engineered building perspective. Now, my feeling is there is a major crisis in consciousness, major crisis in awareness of what is life about. Now, those you might say, well, Natalie, this is not relevant to this discussion. We're talking here about technology. But technology is a representation of who we are. Computers is a representation of our capacity to interconnect. Now, I love what Drew said about everything is a living thing. Everything is a biological, living, evolving thing. We are not taking all those things into consideration. So, first of all, I'm very optimistic. I don't think there's a crisis. It's just a shift, a complete shift in who we are becoming as humans, human beings. And I think it's a huge opportunity for people from their homes, instead of looking for another job in PG&E, to come up with some idea of what they want to bring to the world.
I'm going to jump in here just for a second. Do you have a question?
Yes.
Sorry.
So my question is, what if we take the money concept, the money dollar sign, whatever sign, out of this equation? How can our creativity, fulfillment, joy, exchange, what human will become when you leave, when you move away the sign of dollars from the equation? How else, what is possible for us there? And I think this is interesting.
Anybody want to tackle that?
Well, first you'd be homeless. And I say that not meaning to make a joke of it, but you know, there really are two pieces to the equation, and what we're talking about is sort of the tension between those two. On the very low level, you know, we look at, you know, Japan went through a 10-year downturn economically, and we say, wow, that was a lost decade. That was terrible. But if your plan, if you have a 300-year plan, it's kind of just a blip on the thing. So if we as individuals, I mean, my family sat down and said, what's our 100-year plan? You know, what is the impact of my family, my wife and I and my son, on the human species, on the human experience, on our planet for the next 100 years? And we put it in writing. We built it, you know, it was a pretty long process. It took us a number of months to figure that out. That's the high level. On the low level, if you're not able to pay your mortgage next month, it's painful also. But, you know, those who are trapped there, now's the time you can start moving in that direction, I think.
Why don't we move to the next question here, because we have a number of people there.
Hi, I'm Bruce James. I realize this discussion is for people in their 20s and 30s. I want you to know I've had it twice. I've started a number of businesses in the 70s and 80s in the Bay Area, operated around the world based on technology. I transformed businesses in Central Europe in the 1990s. I've run federal government agencies. And what's really, I bounce back and forth between the coast, between Washington and San Francisco. What's interesting to me is this conversation seems so Bay Area-centric. If we were in Washington right now, guess what? They think they're the center of the universe. And, you know, they're right now taking charge of business. They're deciding winners and losers. They're firing chief executives. They're hiring chief executives. And they're the only ones that have any money. Well, it's our money in the future. But how does the government, what kind of relationships do we create with the federal government in the next generation? How can we best use the government to help us accomplish our purposes? And that's my question.
Paul, did you have an answer for that?
Well, I love the point of your question. I actually think this is a moment where Washington's no longer in charge and it doesn't realize it. In periods of slow change, control is at the center, at the capitals. In periods of rapid change, power moves to the periphery. And I think actually the places that are really in control are the places on the border. Places like the U.S.-Mexican border is the center of indefinable things that are really changing things. But the most important change is the 20th century was a century dominated by the nation state and by national federal capitals. We've moved into a century where it's city states that are really in charge. So even at the federal level, you see the bailout dollars flowing out, but they're being spent at the state level and at the city level and the like. And we're seeing a big power shift. Just a short example, think of our Republican governor 2.5 years ago was asked by the Republican president to send the California National Guard to the Mexican border to protect us against terrorists and people sneaking across. The Republican governor said to the Republican president, no. And then a week later, the Republican governor had a press conference on the shores of the Pacific in Long Beach with a real head of state, Tony Blair, announcing a joint California-UK policy around global climate change in direct opposition to his president. We're already moving into a world of city-states, whether it's California, whether it's the Bay Area, and the federal government just doesn't realize it yet.
Megatropolises. Next question.
So my question is, you know, we're talking about value as a concept, and we're saying value is very poorly defined, and it was poorly defined by a specific group of people, essentially rich white men over hundreds of years. So how are we going to redefine value as, you know, rich white men when we were the ones who messed it up?
I think the head of state of Brazil made that point the other day. Anybody want to talk about? We are a bunch of white men up here on this panel. Any of you want to tackle that?
I wish we were rich.
Any rich white men on the panel? Paul will venture into this.
Okay.
Good. Thank you, Paul.
My friend Paul Hawken really has written deeply on this. And, you know, quite simply, the problem with the value is that the most important things are off balance sheets. And what we need to do as a society is figure out how to get things onto balance sheets that matter. And that's really what the essence of the whole environmental debate is. Think about Jonathan's company. Think about, you know, all the things going on. Is how do we get back onto the balance sheets, the things that matter, so we don't become a victim of the instruments we're using?
Yeah. Next question.
My name is Lyle Sweeney. I've had the opportunity to meet with several business leaders over the last few months, and what I'm finding is the most common characteristic is they're paralyzed and unable to make decisions and take risks. And so the question to the panel is, what do you think are the characteristics of leaders that are going to help pull us through this, what I call is an economic reset? And it's, you know, kind of around the topic of the new technologies and stuff, but it's going to take leaders to help move people through that.
I do want to add here, though, even though our radio audience can't see this, we do have behind us a huge poster of a combination image of Abraham Lincoln and Barack Obama. And I think that's interesting with this question about leadership. To slightly rephrase that question, do we have the leaders in place now that can help us out through this crisis?
Some. is the answer, and there'll be more moving forward, and hopefully a lot more, and hopefully this is an opportunity for new people to emerge and grab the reins. The best thing that happened to my company, to this current company, was we had a technology that made a lot of sense and kind of worked, but didn't. When you really looked under the hood, it was never going to get where it needed to go. And the hardest thing was going and telling the people that gave us money that, it kind of worked. It kind of works, but we really want to turn in a new direction. And we left the discussion a little more bloody than we came in, but with support to fight another day. And I think that there's a lot of that. I mean, you know, you wonder what took them so long to get rid of Wagner at GM? Wow. I remember thinking, you know, months ago, how is this guy who was the architect of a lot of the woes of this company still running it today? And you know what? I got to give the Obama administration a lot of credit. Sometimes it takes someone hitting you head with a mallet, and maybe there'll be more of that moving forward. But I think truly there's going to be a whole new wave of people who emerge either from failure or from hardship who are going to be able to move us forward, and they're going to screw up along the way.
I do have to quickly ask the characteristics of leaders. Are we talking about engineers or druids?
Well, hopefully you're talking about both.
Well, hopefully neither. Philosophers. There's so many debates these days. Yeah, I was sort of reminded of Henry Kissinger in the first few days of the Arab-Israeli Six-Day War. Someone said, "Dr. Kissinger, who would you like to see win?" And he paused and he said, "You know, it would be nice if both sides lost." And there's too much to say. But let me make one recommendation about leadership. There is one book in the last 100 years that I think talks about leadership better than any other, and it was Hermann Hesse's Das Glasperlenspiel, The Glass Bead Game. They don't award Nobel Prizes for books. It's for collected work. But that's the book that pushed Hesse over the top and got him his Nobel Prize. That book speaks extraordinarily eloquently to this moment in time of crisis and the kind of leaders we should have, the leader servants. Read it. It's a great book.
Okay. Next question, please.
Questions for everyone is based on a comment on one that the United States, in 50 years, the United States won't exist. I'm interested in what factors will lead to that. Because if you look at the last 50 years, the number of countries have doubled, or almost doubled. And in fact, even where there's a union like the European Union, Kosovo was created a year ago. So there's actually a trend the other way. So I'm curious what factors.
Will the United States survive? Is that? I mean, it's present form. I don't know, Paul, you're already saying that there may be a difference.
Yeah, I've talked too much. I'll be brief. There are more countries than ever today than in the past, but they matter less. And there are some countries that aren't going to exist at all. Belgium is probably within 3 to 5 years of disappearing. Chile is melting apart as we speak. The U.S. will probably be around as a category. It just won't matter about as much as Belgium. And the only question is, how does the U.S. come apart in a world where city-states, not nation-states, define things? But think about it at the level of meaning. City-states matter because it's a unit of governance that is large enough to have a global impact. Think of Silicon Valley as a de facto city-state. But it's also small enough that everybody sees where they belong. The United States is already a country where there is no common vision in this country of what it means to be an American. Go to another region, and their idea of what being an American is very different than ours. It's not a question of whether the United States disappears, but when and how.
Has there ever been a common view in the U.S. for what it means to be an American at any point in our history?
There actually have been. And there were moments at the end of the Revolution, and there were moments at the end of the Civil War, and very briefly at the end of World War II.
Probably the Second World War was the last time. Drew, I was curious, though, in this area. You talk about creating and manipulating biological units. Does that include something like how we organize ourselves in this manner we're talking about in governments or in units of how we function
I don't think you could, you know, create an artificial barrier at some physical length scale. If you start to work at one level, everything's on the table, and we're already creating societies and social networks and so on, and developing tools for doing that ever more so. So it seems a continuum to me.
Can you give it a nudge? The new technology?
Yeah, I mean, if you put on your hat of a biologist for a second and think about what nature selects for, if you like that model, or even if you don't, you can still go through the exercise. I think we can think about what individuals want, but individuals are not the only things that exist, and it's groups like this, and it's cities, and it's other organizations, whether it's corporations or not. I mean, I think it'd be more interesting to wonder about, could you change the structure of the corporation and where that came from, as opposed to imagining a transition in nation state to city state, which are basically existing in old metaphors. I think it'd be more interesting to look ahead to entirely new ways of organizing. I don't know what that means, but you know, if you look again at the corporation's history, that's not a given. It's something that came from quite a number of empires and their rise and fall and whatnot. So what's after that seems pretty interesting to wonder.
Right, even that developed historically out of predecessors. I'd love to talk more about that, but let's get to another question.
Hi, Candida Martinez. I have a question relating to the fact that we've talked about environmental resources and technology, and that we have this push or this need to create. I remember as a small child in 79 holding my mom's hand waiting for gasoline during that crisis, and there was all this talk about electric cars. It disappeared. Environmental resources. My grandfather built a gray water system in his house in 1979 that existed until the 90s, until his death. And we moved from Northern California to Southern California in the early 80s with a house that already had solar paneling because all that tract home development had it. We had this technology. We had the red flags. We had people talking about it. I asked my dad, I wasn't making this up as a little kid listening to this. And he says, no, there was talk, there was magazines, but what happened? And also the need for science. Everybody keeps saying we need to be more innovative in science. I remember when the first space shuttle went up, we had tons of programs and notebooks and things on learning science and math and big pushes for those units to be learned in school. But then after that event stopped, those units stopped. So does the country have ADD? Is there something going on? You're nodding your head here.
So is there a way to stop this cycle of when the crisis comes, we tend to push new technologies and ideas, and then when we get fat and lazy again, we just let it all slide? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, is there a way of encouraging it? Is there a way of retaining it? Is there what? Because, I mean, obviously people were informed back then and said there was this need. What happened to the people?
Right.
I mean, some, like my grandfather, built systems, and other people just went their way.
Well, Jonathan, algae is a good example of this. And by the way, we haven't really explained this. Algae actually is mostly oil, the organism itself, and you can squeeze it and put it in your tank, and you can make brownies out of it and eat it and all kinds of wonderful things. But this technology was actually developed in the 70s and 80s, in our last oil crisis.
It was first developed actually in the 40s and 50s.
Okay.
My quick answer to your question, though, can we get out of this boom and bust cycle driven by crises is no. I don't really think so. I think it's pretty human, actually. And I think we ought to take advantage of those crises and try and right the ship to the extent we can to try and come up with lasting solutions. But if it's carbon today, it's going to be something else tomorrow anyway, and you can bet on that. So maybe that's not so optimistic, but you know, I think we'll come up with the solutions to the next thing too. Quickly, David, this idea isn't novel at all. We had to come up with novel ways to take advantage of it, and part of that was by really, you know, simple aha moment. Algae's great at making oil. It made the oil in people's cars who drove here today. But you know what? It's not so great in a short period of time at fixing carbon dioxide and sunlight into chemical energy.
Yep.
Other biomass is.
Let's do one more quick question here, if you can keep it brief.
I have a quick question. My name is Angel. I'm originally from Wall Street. My question to you is this. Right now, electric car look like it's the vision of the country. But I asked the commodity expert. They say the technology is not there yet because of the bottleneck of the material. For example, for the battery, right? The best battery you can make right now is from lithium. We don't have enough lithium to make so mass production of electric car. The only thing they tell me can do mass production of the battery for electric car is lead, which is very heavy and a very slow reaction. So is there any new technology can replace the oil at mass production level? Thank you.
Richard?
Yes. There are. There are a number of things.
We have about 30 seconds here.
But we're probably not going to see them for a while, and the reason is that the country, our country, is motivated by capitalism, and as the previous questioner's question really implied, we've known the answers to a lot of these things for a long time, but unless the financial incentives are lined up, you're not going to see them here, unfortunately. But that's the great opportunity for us. Pardon?
So we are going to still depend on oil for a long
unless we change
time.
The economic incentives.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm afraid we'll have to stop there. And let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.